Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now, Atlantic Magazine writer Ta-Nehisi Coates on his epic cover story in this month's magazine, being widely shared, and because it's so long, maybe sometimes even being read. It's called The Case for Reparations. It is not a call for rebate checks or 40 acres and a mule, and it has to do with a lot more than slavery. Ta-Nehisi Coates, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'll say VLDR. Instead of TLDR, too long, didn't read, VLDR, very long, did read, amazing piece. And I think a lot of people, many of them who didn't actually read it, are reacting strongly to your article because of the use of the word reparations in the title. So do you want to just define it right at the outset here in the way that you mean it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in the terms that it's used in the article, it is an accounting, both a moral accounting and, you know, should we, you know, prove be able to do so, a fiscal accounting for essentially 350 years, including enslavement, but not limited to enslavement, of the systemic pilfering of wealth out of African-American communities.
And your definition of reparations is not a specific cash program. Some of the words from your article: reparations, by which I mean the full acceptance of our collective biography and its consequences, is the price we must pay to see ourselves squarely. What would full acceptance involve?
Well, we don't know. We don't know. And one of the things that the article actually argues for in terms of concrete, tangible steps right now is the support of H.R. 40, which Congressman John Conyers has introduced into Congress for almost 25 years now. It's never made it to the floor under Democrats or Republicans. And when I say we don't know, it's not a dodge. It's the fact that when you talk about 350 years, when you're talking about enslavement, when you're talking about terrorism, when you're talking about redlining, when you're talking about housing discrimination, when you're talking about job discrimination, it's a lot. It's the broad swath of American history, and it deserves to be studied. And I think this attempt to put a really quick number on it, or to, you know, enact some sort of plan, I took 16,000 words just to make the case. The actual conclusions of what that would look like probably deserve a lot more.
This is WNYC FM HD in AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJO 90.3 Toms River 2, New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Listeners, we know this article has resonated with many of you. We'll even say that it's in the front running for most talked about essay of 2014. I even saw someone from the Atlantic Tech Department tweet the other day saying that the level of traffic to this piece gives him hope for the future of serious journalism. So if you've read any of Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Case for Reparations, or want to engage with him on the ideas even as he articulates them here, if it's the first time you're hearing them, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And since this is so rooted in the history that you tell, let's go through some of the history, and then we'll come back in the second half to what you mean by reparations and what kinds of bills in Congress and things like that might constitute them, as well as what changes in our consciousness. But moving past things that most people know about slavery or Jim Crow, you write about the New Deal era, which many progressives point to as the pinnacle of liberal social and economic policy, as actually being very much a product of Jim Crow racism. How so?
Well, anybody who looked at the political map at the time would immediately observe that the Democratic majority was ensured by what they called the Solid South. And that is, you know, primarily, you know, Democrats in the South, basically holding on to seats and controlling the South in Congress. The New Deal would not be possible, obviously, without Southern Democrats. And those Southern Democrats generally held as their number one priority the upholding of white supremacy. So when things, for instance, like the GI Bill or the Social Security or unemployment insurance, when these programs were proposed, senators and congressmen in the South were very much concerned that these programs be tailored in such a way that they not violate what was termed euphemistically as the Southern way of life, which is effectively black peonage. And that's exactly what happened. Social Security, for instance, the way it was initially passed, effectively barred folks who worked in agriculture and folks who worked in maid services and domestic services from receiving Social Security. Now, if you looked at the South at the time, what you would observe is that the majority of African Americans worked in those occupations, and the way it was tailored was quite effective. I think initially only 65% of African Americans in this country were not eligible for Social Security. 80% of African Americans in the South were not eligible for Social Security. You can see that same mark over unemployment insurance. You can see the GI Bill being tailored in a similar way to make sure that African Americans did not get the same access to the boon of these programs. The New Deal legislation is not possible without white supremacy.
And so in 1935, as you point out, the NAACP protested that the new American safety net of the New Deal was, quote, a sieve with holes just big enough for the majority of Negroes to fall through, unquote. And what about the GI Bill? You mean the black soldiers coming back from World War II didn't get the same benefits, we think of them as usually for housing and for education, as the white veterans?
No, they didn't. They didn't. And in fact, again, the GI Bill came under the sway of Congressman John Rankin, who was a congressman out of Mississippi, a notorious anti-Semite and bigot, on the record, actual bigot. I believe he called Adam Clayton Powell a word that I can't use on here, but a well-known slur for African-Americans. And this is in the congressional record. Anyway, he structured, he was, you know, very interested in structuring the bill in such a way that this wave of African-American soldiers who were coming home from World War II would not be in a position to threaten, again, the quote-unquote Southern way of life. And the way that was done was all the benefits of the GI Bill were funneled into the states and into local VA agencies. So if you were an African-American coming back from the war into Mississippi, as, you know, the protagonist of my story, Clyde Ross, was, for instance, you would have to tangle with the Veterans Administration in Mississippi, in Tennessee, in Florida, in Texas. Those officials made sure that the way that the GI Bill was actually employed matched up with the way of life, with segregation, that is to say.
Mary in Grant City, you're on WNYC. Hello, Mary.
Good morning. I'm calling to find out if there's been research similar to what was in this article. I read the article. It was wonderful. I'm wondering if there's similar research in the field of education. You know how in the article he talks about how mortgage laws are written to marginalize black neighborhoods. Is there any way you can say the same thing for Pell Grants and student loans? Anybody who's done research to see how that affects different races of people?
That's an excellent question.
Thank you.
I think, yeah, no, it really is. It really is. And it was one of the things that I confronted early on when I was writing the article, because it came to my mind. I knew a little bit about housing, but it came to my mind that one might make the case from the perspective of criminal justice, from the perspective of healthcare, from the perspective of education. We know, for instance, when Virginia schools were integrated, that in some counties, folks basically shut down the public school system to avoid integration. African Americans paid a cost for that. And I think, yes, you know, a similar article could be written, you know, looking at the history of education in this country and looking at African Americans. My research was focused on housing. My hope is that some folks out there will be similarly inspired and make the case through different lenses.
Thank you, Barry. And so, for example, on housing, you write that as late as 1950, the National Association of Real Estate Boards had a code of ethics that warned that, quote, a realtor should never be instrumental in introducing into a neighborhood any race or nationality or any individuals whose presence will clearly be detrimental to property values. Now, that was in the private sector, the National Association of Real Estate Boards.
Yes.
But there's another example of codification almost as a moral standard in and of itself, racial discrimination.
Right. And there's another quote just to go along with that follows that, I believe, in the piece, where the Trade Association for Realtors basically gives an idea of what they mean. And they talk about pimps, prostitutes, madams, or a colored person of means who believes that he has the right to live around white people. And so you have to understand what that means. Effectively, a African-American who has achieved some level of success in America is being equated by the Trade Association for Realtors with criminals. And then that was compounded by actual government actions such as redlining, where you had the FHA and the HOLC literally producing maps that were coded in different colors, different letters, ethnicity and race being basically one of the main determinants in there. African American neighborhoods or neighborhoods where even a small population of African Americans lived were coded red and were judged ineligible for any subsidization, any insurance through the FHA.
And listeners, if you want to follow along specifically on that thought, go to our website because we've posted a mid-century map used by the Homeowners Loan Corporation that shows the way the borough was redlined, Brooklyn in particular. It's amazing. You can see the particular neighborhood shaded in red right there on the map. A lot of people are looking at it right now. We can see on our traffic. Go check it out on our site. An actual redlining map from the mid-20th century for Brooklyn. We've also got a link to similar maps for Chicago, Houston, Boston, and lots of other cities inspired by Ta-Nehisi Coates' article in The Atlantic. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehr Show. Ta-Nehisi, I wonder how you think of morality as a factor in your argument, which has already come up. But am I right to say that in a way you're trying to get past the notion of slavery and Jim Crow as this moral injustice as a case for reparations and recast it as an economic taking, as you put it?
Well, there's a moral question at the heart of it in the sense that if you, effectively, as I argue in the piece, plunder a group for 350 years, what is owed to them? So there is a kind of moral justice argument. But you are correct in the sense that I think in often, when we talk about the struggle against racism, the struggle in whites against white supremacy in this country, we imagine two groups that, just kind of don't like each other because they look different than each other. It's the reason why, the most quoted portion of any Martin Luther King speech is, the I have a dream portion. I have a dream that little white girls and, little black girls, or I'm mangling the quote right now, but we'll hold hands together. We imagine it as a disease of the heart. When in fact, the most damaging aspect of white supremacy and of racism in this country has always been a disease of the wallet, and that is the taking of African of the possessions of African Americans, doing enslavement, the literal taking of the fruits of labor from black people, the taking of their children and auctioning them off, the taking of their bodies and using them for rape and torture. And this taking doesn't end with slavery. It proceeds out into the Jim Crow era. It proceeds in terms of taking African American tax dollars and promulgating a public university system, for instance, that African Americans aren't allowed to use, erecting libraries that African Americans aren't allowed to use, erecting public parks, public pools that African Americans aren't allowed to use, taking, barring African Americans from the vote, and thus, barring them from any ability to have any sort of say in how their tax dollars are used. The point here is plunder. It's not, necessarily the disease of the heart.
And one amazing stat from your piece, going back to 1860, still slavery, there were more millionaires per capita in the Mississippi Valley than anywhere else in the country.
Yes, and it makes sense. It makes sense.
Before we get to some calls, and our board is full, so people be patient. We'll have Sabrina in Brooklyn who maybe wishes you used a word other than reparations because that word is already loaded for people about what the response to all of this should be, and we'll go on from there. But one of the great things about the piece is that you used a particular person and a particular neighborhood to tell a lot of this story. So much of your story is told through the life of a man named Clyde Ross of North Lawndale, Illinois, Chicago, born 1923 and still alive there today, past his 90th birthday. Who is Clyde Ross, and how is his story the story of North Lawndale?
Well, Mr. Clyde Ross is a philosopher. That's the first thing I'd say about him. He was actually the first person I interviewed in North Lawndale, and when I walked into his home and sat down, the first question I asked, I said, "Mr. Ross, where are you originally from?" He said, "Clarksdale, Mississippi." Second question I asked was, "Mr. Ross, how did you end up in Chicago?" And he said, "I came to Chicago because I was seeking the protection of the law." And I didn't quite understand what he was saying. He has kind of a Mississippi accent still. And I asked him to repeat. He said, I was seeking the protection of the law. And I said, what did you mean by that? He said, well, in Mississippi, we had no black district attorneys. We had no black prosecutors, no black judges, no black police officers, no black defense attorneys. Effectively, if something happened to us, we had no protection at all. The law afforded us nothing. And then he cataloged his life, which, you know, basically bore this out. He was born into a family that was relatively well off compared to other African Americans, you know, in the Clarksdale region, had land, had, you know, livestock. This was taken from them in a tax dispute to which they had no appeal, no protection of the law, as he alluded to. Mr. Ross's only childhood possession was a horse, which he loved. A group of white men appeared to him when he was very, very young and said, we want that horse. His father said, you know, why? And he said, why? And his father said, no, you have to give it to them because they'll kill us all. They took the horse, put it on the racetrack. Mr. Ross's brother, Winter, had epilepsy, had a seizure in town, was taken into the notorious Parchman labor farm, which, you know, anybody who's familiar with Mississippi knows about. Parchman was effectively modern 20th century slavery. They went to retrieve their brother, Winter, found out he had died, couldn't even retrieve his body. And this is what I mean about plunder, the constant taking of things down to black people's bodies, horses, land, everything. And when he came to Chicago, he fell victim to redlining and found himself plundered all over again.
So here's a bit from a video on your site, on the Atlantic website, that accompanies your piece. This is another Lawndale resident, Ethel Weatherspoon, followed by a bit of 1960s NBC Chicago report on housing discrimination. Ethel Weatherspoon of North Lawndale, Illinois.
Everyone that was black, they had been sold a contract. If you missed a payment in 3 months, they could take the property back. No lawyer, no nothing could help you. That was it.
There are blocks like this scattered throughout the Lawndale section of Chicago's West Side ghetto. The people who live here bought their homes from real estate speculators at double or triple their value, and they bought on contract because they couldn't get conventional or FHA mortgages. Under the contract, the buyer makes installment payments at high interest, but he builds no equity. If he defaults on even one payment at any time during the contract, he loses the property and everything he's paid into it.
And yes, that's what NBC News sounded like in the 1960s in Chicago. It's not Brian Williams talking to Edward Snowden. But this is something that we talked about on the show with Jamelle Bouie of Slate recently. What was in that clip? Studies show that even today, wealthy blacks tend to live in much poorer neighborhoods than wealthy whites. So can you tease out the practical effect of that? Why is it harder to accumulate wealth if you're surrounded by poverty? If you have a good job, good savings habits, can't you control your own financial destiny?
Well, no, you can't. And the first thing to recognize, you know, as you think of this historically, we know that wealth is accumulated generationally. So you're talking about a group of people who were effectively cut out what one scholar calls the greatest wealth building opportunity in American history. So if you start with black people being, and by that we mean the home ownership boom that was built, you know, it was socially engineered in the mid 20th century. If you start with African Americans being largely cut out of that from beginning, you're talking about a group of people who are behind from the start. And then they're surrounded by other people who are themselves behind. African Americans are the most segregated ethnic group in this country. And so not only are you individually plundered, your entire network, everyone you're around, is also plundered. And anyone that knows anything about social capital and how networks work in this country, effectively your network, even if you yourself, you know, prove to be a successful individual of high income, that says nothing about the people you're connected to. To make this really, really explicit, I may go to college, you know, get a great degree and, you know, get a really nice Wall Street job. But because I am black and because I'm from a plundered community, it's much more likely that I will, for instance, have to take care of my mother, take care of my father. It's much more likely that my younger brother or younger sister or older brother or older sister may not have followed. I have a cousin that I may have to deal with. The people I know, the people who I went to school with, my closest intimates, don't tend to be the kind of intimates that other people who grew up in different circumstances tend to be. When you begin to understand and begin to look at black people as part of a broader community and white people as part of broader communities, many of the things that appear mysterious to us are not mysterious at all.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, Atlantic Magazine writer, with us talking about his epic cover story in this month's magazine, The Case for Reparations. When we continue, your calls, and we'll ask him, reparations like what? Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Atlantic Magazine writer Ta-Nehisi Coates and his epic cover story in this month's magazine being so widely shared and even sometimes read in its 16,000-word glory called The Case for Reparations. Sabrina in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Sabrina.
Hi, Tanisha. This is Sabrina Dykus. I really appreciate your article. Something that occurred to me is a lot of the concepts that you're talking about have been concepts that a lot of people have been talking about for a while. You know, for example, I just saw A Raisin in the Sun on Broadway about these very issues. And I wonder if using the word reparations sets us back and, you know, sort of turns the conversation back into the same conversation we've been having for a long time. And maybe introducing a new word that articulates the same issues would make it more likely for us to have a serious conversation that includes affirmative action and legacy and includes healthcare issues.
I think that's highly unlikely. And just to give an example, the lead in the piece deals with the Contract Buyers League, who brought suit against the city of Chicago, against the federal government, and against the shadow lenders who are operating in North Lawndale. Their claim was against, you know, an existing group. The city of Chicago was obviously existing. The United States government, FHA, obviously existing. The lenders were right there. It was not rooted in slavery. But it was rooted in the language of race and racism. It was rooted in a specific offense. It did not use the term reparations. There were two suits that came out of Chicago like this. Neither one of them were successful. And in the suit that involved the Contract Buyers League on the West Side, just to give you know, some mindset of how the jury felt about this, the foreman was interviewed after the trial. And when asked about the verdict, he said he hoped the verdict would set things right and restore some of the stuff that had went wrong with Brown versus the board. So it was very clear where the psychology was. I think the American people are really, really smart. And I think efforts to, fool them by, claiming something is, by coming up with new words, new phrases. Progressives have tried this quite a bit. I think, don't prove to be particularly effective.
Sabrina,
I think it is what it is. And I think we also should face it, by the way.
Sabrina, thank you. But since your argument, Ta-Nehisi, is about so much more than money, why not pick a broader term like truth and reconciliation, like they used in South Africa after apartheid, or something like that?
I see no evidence that other terminology would be more effective. We've been, this pretends that other people haven't, tried to use other terminology to talk about African Americans and the troubles we face. Liberals, for many years now, have moved away from any conversation about racism and have tried to talk about African American problems in terms of class. That hasn't been proven to be any more successful. President Barack Obama, when he introduced the Affordable Care Act, did not use the term reparations. Did not note the obvious truth that yes, it would disproportionately benefit African Americans if it were passed the way he wanted it to be passed. I'm pretty sure the president knows this. I'm pretty sure liberals in Congress knows this.
You argue that Obamacare would have failed if he had done it that way, even though people
But the argument is not that he should call it reparations. What I'm saying is that didn't stop people on the right from calling it reparations. My argument is not that he should, that's a political tack that he should take. But what I'm saying is people name things and people see things anyway. People see, racism anyway. I don't think you can fool people into doing things.
Latifa in Harlem, you're on WNYC with Ta-Nehisi Coates. Hi, Latifa.
Hi, Ta-Nehisi, and hi, Brian. I really want to thank you for writing that article. It took me 3 days to read it just because I had to keep putting it down because so much of it rang true for me and my family. My great aunt actually was a domestic for a woman in Boston for about 35, 40 years. And when the woman died, she realized that she was taking her money that she was supposed to be investing into Social Security and did not. And my great aunt had absolutely nothing to show for all of her years of work. And I hate to say it, but thankfully, she got struck by a taxi cab here in New York because she had to take another job in her later years as a domestic and ended up winning a substantial settlement from the city and took it and retired in Georgia. And I always wonder, too, like when I go back to my hometown of Grand Rapids, Michigan, when I visit my family home, which is immaculate, and thank God that my uncle knows is a handyman and he can build anything. And this is like the most beautiful gem, and the neighborhood around it is falling apart. And it's just like, and it literally makes you feel like you're crazy. Like you're doing everything right, and it just seems like nothing ever materializes. And I just wanted to thank you for writing that because you put a voice to something that was always in my head, and I always wondered, like, is it true or is it really just us? And thank you.
Thank you. And I just want to highlight something about that. That is, you know, the natural result when you cut people out of the American state, when you cut people out of policy. That you know, pretty much is a mirror image of what happened to black folks who were redlined. Folks who can't find legitimate ways into the system end up retreating to illegitimate ways. And God knows how many African Americans were plundered in exactly that fashion.
Latifa, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call and your story. And Dave in Irvington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good morning, Brian. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I haven't called you, believe it or not, in years since you were calling the show On the Line.
Good to hear from you again.
Yes. Mr. Coates, I just want to say that I'm going to disagree with you, but I thank you for being a reasonable voice. I thank you for not yelling and screaming, you know, and being all crazy about it. But I must tell you, I am a black American of Caribbean background. I am absolutely opposed to reparations, always have been. And again, I'm not including you in this bunch because you're reasonable. But I feel that those who scream the loudest about reparations, I feel that it's racial hustle. I think that, you know, there is an attempt by the hard, hard left, you know, and by Randall Robinson and Louis Farrakhan and individuals like that to keep us angry at America, to keep us angry at white people. And the fact of the matter is that America has come a long way. You know, I'm a civil rights activist with the Congress of Racial Equality, and I see progress being made day after day, year after year, month after month. And I really feel that there are some black leaders who just do not want to acknowledge the success that we've made as a people and as a nation. And by, you know, by screaming for reparations, you know, and by always, you know, making it seem like America is this horrible place to live, even after the civil rights movement, I feel that it's an injustice in and of itself. And I use the word hustle because I really believe that's what it is.
Ta-Nehisi, talk to Dave.
Well, I can't answer for other people. I certainly can't answer for Randall Robinson or Louis Farrakhan. But, you know, I can only say that the idea that America has progressed, and it has, there's no question about that, is not really a counterargument against reparations. People who have been injured can progress when a person stops injuring them. That doesn't make the injury go away. You know, if I've been beaten and stabbed and left bleeding on the corner, it's progress that somebody has stopped beating and stabbing me. That's definitely progress. But that doesn't have, you know, much to do with the fact of the injury. If we can accept, and I think we can, that home buying, as we know it, was a huge wealth-building opportunity in this country. If we can accept that African Americans were cut out of this, forget slavery. Let's just put slavery aside. Let's talk about this one particular thing. If we can accept that African Americans were cut out of it, if we can accept that the story that Latifa just told when she called on the line about her grandmother is not particularly original, if we can accept that, then some justice, some sort of restoration, some sort of repair, it seems, should be due. It just seems like, you know, I know we were trying to get away from this, Brian, but it seems like a basic question of morality. Now, what we can do and what we can't do, you know, it might be a question of practicality, but the basic argument seems pretty clear and established to me. And I don't think that, you know, you need to hate America to believe that. On the contrary, you know, I think, you know, I experience this, as I say in the piece, as a profound act of patriotism, because I don't believe that love is looking at someone and, you know, telling them that everything about them is great, that they, when they wake up in the morning, their breath smells like peppermint, they never need to take a shower. I mean, love is looking at somebody, you know, directly, seeing them, you know, for real, speaking to them in a direct and honest fashion, and loving them nonetheless. Less. And I think that's the kind of patriotism, that's the kind of love of country that I urge African Americans and all Americans towards.
Dave, did he get you at all?
You know, he's the first voice I've heard, you know, to make the argument respectfully and reasonably, but I still disagree. I still hold to, you know, my core belief that, you know, the idea of reparations is ludicrous in 2014.
Even if expressed in bills like Obamacare, let's say, because lack of health insurance was a disparate impact against blacks, so Obamacare helps to write that. Do you see that as reparations that, you know, somehow violate your principles of what's equal in America?
No, I think that, you know, Obamacare, and I'm a conservative, you know, philosophically, but I feel that the argument for Obamacare is more of an argument for, you know, on a human level for all Americans. Mm-hmm. But the argument for reparations, I really believe, is coming from a point of victimology.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Do you believe Japanese Americans deserved reparations for internment?
Yes, to a degree, but you know, the Japanese internment was years and years after slavery. And you still have, you know, Japanese Americans, you know,
but
today.
It was years and years before. Well, it wasn't years. It was a few years before redlining. I mean, redlining extends at least into the 1960s. So, I mean, we like I said, we can let slavery go, but we're talking about 20th century ills with people who are still alive right now. Mr. Clive Ross is still alive. Ethel Weatherspoon is still alive.
And, Dave, I'm going to leave it there. I appreciate your call. You mentioned Japanese American reparations. A stretch of your article is an analogy with German reparations to the Jews after the Holocaust. In 1952, you note, most Germans in a poll did not feel guilty and did not feel the country owed the Jews anything. So I guess you're making an analogy with how a lot of white Americans feel here. But you also write about a strong sentiment in Israel at the time against accepting reparations from Germany, led by Menachem Begin and others, who did not want to help launder Germany's reputation by accepting cash. And I'm curious why you included that storyline. Would you fear that, you know, accepting reparations in whatever form would be laundering America's reputation?
No, and mostly because of, you know, we have the Israeli and German example to see that it, in fact, did not launder Germany's reputation. In fact, you know, on the contrary, Germany went on a long period of deep, you know, consideration about the role it had played in the Holocaust and what it had actually done. Having said that, I can understand the argument very much. I mean, a lot of, you know, the voices that I quote are people whose, you know, relatives, brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers had literally been killed. And so, you know, it's not, you know, particularly insane that they would feel like by taking money that they were somehow, you know, cleaning Germany or taking money, you know, on behalf of, you know, the ghost of their families. So the concern, you know, in that case, you know, is really understandable. The thing I wanted to point to by using that example is because, you know, it so often comes up is to say that it's always difficult. It's always going to, you know, going to be difficult. So any sort of, you know, difficulties that we would face in America are generally the difficulties that are faced when you deal with reparations period. It's always a hard conversation.
And so to liberals who might think of reparations as distasteful because it's sort of like hush money, you say get past it.
It's not hush money. It can never be hush money. You know, I don't you know, understand. It can't be hush money. It just, you know, I'm not sure how that would work.
My guest, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who wrote the epic cover story in The Atlantic this month, The Case for Reparations, and Janice in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hi, Janice.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. Mr. Coates, I want to thank you so much for this conversation. The first caller was concerned about the word reparation arose by any other name. And so time for conversation on what it's to be called. I think it should be over. 40 acres and a mule, I think that if we had were given 40 acres and a mule, we would be taxed out of the land and our animals could be taken away as in the article that was the audio that we heard. I think that the reparation that African Americans that should be due us is that similar to the Native Americans, where we have paid into this country with blood, sweat, and tears. I think by us paying taxes is us paying more when we shouldn't have to. We should be like a Native Americans and not have to pay into the pay taxes anymore. I think that that would be a very viable solution and just a step toward making it right, because it even as far as Mr. Coates named so many of the ills, the evils that have been perpetrated against us, but things like our jobs being outsourced out of the country, and then when we're without jobs to say we're lazy and we now need help from the government and that's too much government, it is an evil.
All right. How about that as a reparation, Ta-Nehisi?
Possibly.
Tax exemptions.
Possibly. You know, again, you know, I stopped short of proposing a plan because I think people are really, you know, and you know that maybe, but I think people are really underestimating how complicated it actually would be figuring out how to get this done. It doesn't mean that it's impossible, but I think it would be quite a complicated process.
And also, so many poor people don't pay income tax as it is because they're in, you know, what Mitt Romney famously let everybody know is the bottom 47%, that maybe that's not the way to address the wealth disparity issue today. But when we announced that you would be on the show yesterday, and I want to bring this up, and the caller Dave in Irvington was getting at it as well, but several people sent us links to pieces that accuse you of basically playing into a narrative of victimhood. And someone sent us an interview with Bill Cosby, of course, Bill Cosby from a couple of years ago, where he chides black leaders for basically sending the message to blacks that the system is rigged and that it's hopeless. So what's your response to that line of criticism? Do you serve to actually discourage people?
Well, the system is rigged and has been rigged, and it's been rigged for 350 years. I mean, I don't, you know, there's not much dispute about that. For most of American history, for the vast, vast swath of American and colonial history, the system was rigged, and there's evidence, you know, that I, you know, present towards the end of the article that it still very much is rigged. Our mass incarceration crisis didn't appear out of nowhere. African American males comprise some minuscule portion of the world's population, and yet 8% of the entire incarcerated population. That would lead you to believe there is some rigging. That's not the same as saying there's no hope. You know, I have a son lives here in New York City who I have to send off to school every day. I had parents who were very aware of, you know, American history and the history of racism in this country. As an individual, of course, there's hope. There's always hope. But I don't quite understand the logic of how critiquing your country means that, you know, you therefore believe that it's no hope. Listen, America is a state built by human beings. Things built by human beings tend to be fallible, and we are always and should be always about the work of trying to improve them. I don't know how we do that without some sort of analysis, without some sort of critique.
And where does this all dovetail with the role of culture and personal responsibility? Even President Obama, as you know, has talked about the need for individuals to take accountability. For example, this is from his commencement speech at Morehouse College last spring.
But along with collective responsibilities, we have individual responsibilities. There are some things as black men we can only do for ourselves. There are some things as Morehouse men that you are obliged to do for those still left behind. As Morehouse men, you now wield something even more powerful than the diploma you're about to collect, and that's the power of your example.
So, Ta-Nehisi, what do you think when you hear the president talk that way, and how does it relate or not to your article?
I'm deeply disappointed, and I've been, you know, quite vocal about that fact. no one has yet to present me with any evidence that the 40 million African Americans who live in this country are somehow less personally responsible than the rest of the country. When I see that evidence, I can respond to it. I've seen no evidence of that yet.
And you wrote, the kind of trenchant racism to which black people have persistently been subjected can never be defeated by making its victims more respectable. The essence of American racism is disrespect. And in the wake of the grim numbers, we see the grim inheritance. That's from your article. Are you arguing that if there's a disproportionate number of men who are in prison or men who are not supporting the children who they're not the, you know, custodial fathers of, that's the legacy of racism? Is that how they connect?
Well, you know, here's the thing. I think when we deal with the socioeconomic indicators in African American life, we have strong historical policy evidence. We can look at the history of the country, look at the policy, policies of this country. You know, as I tried to lay out 350 years worth of policy, and we can see what the effects are. Culture is considerably harder to quantify. And, you know, sociologists talk about this all the time. And yet, you know, for some reason, we're much, much more eager to talk about that which we can't quantify than that which we can. And from that perspective, you know, that points me or leads me to believe that there's some sort of hesitancy, some sort of, you know, cowardice, as our Attorney General once called it, you know, about looking at ourselves. African Americans aren't the only people who owe themselves a debt of responsibility or should be personally responsible. The American state should be personally responsible for what it's done for the past 350 years. American society should be responsible to its own history. The American government should be responsible to itself also. I'd love to hear more talk about that.
Let's take one more call for Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of the being very widely read and widely shared Case for Reparations, cover story in The Atlantic this month. Latasha in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Latasha.
Hello, how are you, Brian? How are you, Ta-Nehisi? I just wanted to follow up. I'm in total agreement with him based on the personal story of mine when he was speaking earlier about how if you do graduate college and you get a good job, you may be surrounded by others who are not like you or who have not made it, and then it's harder for you to overcome it still. I mean, I lost my job early in 2000s on Wall Street, and because I was not connected socially with others who were in the same field in my community, it was hard for me to get back in, even though I had the skill set and the experience and so forth. So I'm in agreement with that. But I also want to point out something else, too, in that, like, I was listening to the radio about how lately New York City police officers will have the medicine to counteract heroin overdose. Well, how is it that when it's a problem on a large scale and for whites, all of a sudden, that is being fixed? And I think that's what Mr. Coates is getting at the heart of it, is this is a problem in America that is largely affecting African Americans, the issue of reparations. Why can't we just address it? Historically, when there is a problem, we always address it. Why is it that when it comes to African Americans, we just can't address this as, you know, a historical solution? And I'll take my answer off air.
Thank you for your call.
Well, I think Natasha points to two things that are really important. She just named, you know, there's a heroin problem, and she just named a solution that, you know, the city of New York is going to implement. And the city of New York is going to implement that because it believes it has some sort of responsibility to the citizens that live here. Deciding that, you know, the police should, you know, carry around, you know, antidotes for people who are ODing on heroin is not an ad that says people should therefore go and do heroin. It does not mean that people do not have personal responsibility to keep away from drugs and to not use heroin. That's not how we read that policy. And the second thing I think she pointed to was how, you know, we have a very selective implementation of history. You know, we talked about this a little earlier, the idea that, well, reparations was for something that happened a long time ago. You know what else was also a long time ago? The Revolutionary War. No one's in any hurry to forget the Revolutionary War. We want to forget those aspects of history that somehow do not flatter us. Those aspects of history that do flatter us, we're very interested in. As you know, I say in the piece, everybody wants to get together on July 4th. It doesn't matter whether your ancestors came here in 1880, 1980, or 1990. If you're American, everybody wants to celebrate July 4th. Well, guess what? this is part of it, too. This is part of being American, too. You don't just get the good.
By the way, SKV on our comments page asks, quote, please ask Mr. Coates if he thinks women are owed reparations for the long history of misogynistic oppression, lack of right to vote, own property, have sovereignty over their own bodies, etc.
I have no idea. I would love to read a 16,000-word article making the case, too, and then I would make my judgment.
All right. Final question. I'm just curious. Have you heard from President Obama? Do you think he's read your piece?
I have not heard from President Obama. I hope he's read my piece. But I don't hope he comes out in favor of reparations.
You don't hope he comes out in favor of reparations?
Absolutely not.
Because?
Absolutely not.
Because?
Well, because I think people, you know, that's not actually how movements are built. You know, movements are built from the ground up. It doesn't, you know, start with the president. The president should be responding to some on-the-ground, you know, movement. I hope, you know, what happens is exactly what I state in the article, that there's some sort of groundswell to support H.R. 40. We can have a study. We can get some, you know, get our hands around what the injury is, get some possible remedies on the table, and then you can start talking about, you know, the president, you know, the highest official of the land.
You don't want our leaders to lead?
No, because I don't think that's how American politics actually works. Healthcare, the fight for healthcare did not begin with President Obama, and I'm pretty sure it didn't begin in the White House either.
Ta-Nehisi Coates' article, all 16,000 words of it, the cover story in The Atlantic this month, the case for reparations. Thank you so much for giving us so much time today.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up next. And finally today, how would you like to be forgotten online? Not how would you like to be remembered. How would you like to be forgotten online? We'll take your calls and look at how a recent court decision in Europe is letting more Europeans try to abolish links to their most embarrassing moments. Stay with us.